So let's cultivate our motivation for our time here today. There are so many things that everyone here could have stayed home to do today, with this being December. Before coming to the Abbey, about this time of year, I was starting to feel quite tired. And then it was the race towards finishing up at school, traveling to where my family was, shopping, going to year-end Christmas parties. The racetrack just seemed to get faster and faster. And certainly before I met the Dharma, I didn't use a lot of discretion on how to slow down amidst the race. I just took part in it. I thought it was normal. I believed it was the right thing to do. And the wear and tear was enormous. And it certainly didn't make me happy. So in coming to hear the teachings today, we have the time, and everyone has made the pretty big effort to get here to reflect on the chapter that we'll look at, the kindness of others. And we can choose as spiritual practitioners to slow down. We can choose to engage in things that are meaningful and not just go with the flow. And we can choose to really challenge the self-centered thought that wants to steer our attention away from others onto ourselves. But in steering our attention towards others, hearing, thinking, reflecting on what's virtuous and beneficial to do, we can actually easily make it through this very busy time, not be worn out or stressed or exhausted, and actually be a resource for others. So let's rejoice that we have this opportunity today to listen, reflect, and meditate on these teachings. And in doing that, we'll be able to be of benefit to others now. And if we have the idea of full awakening in our mind and heart, we just keep putting one foot in front of the other, headed in that direction. So it's so wonderful to see so many people here on December the 8th. So welcome, everyone. This topic that we're going to look at, chapter 26 in this book, is actually the first topic I ever heard taught. It was my first encounter with the Dharma, and it was my first time hearing Venerable Thupten Chodron teach. And I was raised a Catholic. I thought I knew something about kindness. But when I heard her unpack this topic in 1996, it actually blew my head off, the way she unpacked it, the way she had us meditate on it. And at the time, I wasn't a Buddhist. I had no intention of becoming a Buddhist. I was just visiting my friend in Seattle, and she dragged me to this teaching. And that is true. I was hoping we would go out for a nice Seattle dinner. That didn't happen. Fortunately, it didn't happen, because otherwise I would not be here. That's a given. So it's a topic that we can all, I think it's very accessible to anybody. So we'll do like Venerable Children does. We'll go through this chapter, I'll read it out loud, and I'll just pause every now and then and give you some of my thoughts and maybe ask for some of yours. For sure, I'll ask for some of your thoughts. And let's see how this talk will inspire us today. So she writes, in our everyday lives, we are often unaware of how much we depend on others just to stay alive. And as a result, we often take their kindness and efforts on our behalf for granted. When we pause and consider that we are all dependent on one another, we realize that everything we have, everything we know, and everything we're able to do has come about due to the kindness of others. We are not the independent, pick yourself up by your own bootstraps individuals that we sometimes pride ourselves in being. So I think if you take this book, or you have it, and if you take this first paragraph that I just read, I think you could meditate on this first paragraph for about the next year and really, really get into it. But how many people here have in the past, maybe when you were younger, maybe you still have this idea that, leave me alone, I can take care of myself, I don't need your help, I'm fine, I can do it alone. Has anyone discovered that that might be not the truth? Yeah, I used to think that. I can still think that way. So that's something to really look at if you have some holiday time coming up. Take a look at that first paragraph in chapter 6 and see what's going on for you now with that paragraph. So Venerable goes on to get us thinking in this direction. Think about the food you ate for lunch. And you can do this as you're eating today, because part of the lunch hour actually will be eating in silence. So you can do this. Where did this food come from? Some people grew it, others harvested it, another person transported it, and some others packaged it. Then there are the people who put it on the shelves in the stores, the person at the checkout counter, and whoever cooked it. Without the efforts of all these people, we wouldn't even have a mouthful of food to eat. So in thinking about this talk today about 10 days ago, I thought, well, I'm going to look into one type of food and really find out what's going on behind this thing that, you know, you go to the store, you pick it up, you get it on your table, right? And there it is. That's mine to eat. Without, you know, thinking about all the countless numbers of people involved. So did anyone here ever have the experience of picking oranges for a living? Okay, well, I'm going to share some information with you that actually for me was sobering. And I see how arrogant I am about what shows up on the table. I just assume it's going to be there. And I'm really not so attentive as to what's gone into that showing up on the table or in your home. So I got this information from it was a very interesting video, and it focuses on one place in California that harvests and grows oranges and packages them. But I think it's pretty much the same throughout the world how this is done. So someone who was talking about being an orange picker said this, "Orange picking is probably one of the hardest fruit picking jobs around. You have to wear this fruit picking bag." So you might want to Google this sometime over the holidays. So if orange fruit picker, you have to wear this canvas bag. It's quite large. And then you have to go up this ladder. And then you can't just pull the fruit off the tree, you have to snip it. So some of these bags, some of the people who do this for a living, they can put almost 30 kilograms of fruit into one bag. So that is actually 66 pounds. Now, I couldn't do that job. I'm simply too small. So I thought, okay, well, what if I could do 20 kilograms? Well, that's still 44 pounds. I couldn't do that job. And I thought, well, maybe I could do 10 kilograms. That's 22 pounds. That's a hefty load going up and down a ladder multiple times a day. And then you get paid on how much you pick. I'd be fired on the first day. You know, if I was trying to support a family and this was my, you know, job I was going to do to feed my kids and my partner, well, we'd be starving to death because I wouldn't last on the job. So the person who's talking about this job says, wearing this bag, clambering up and down the ladder can be quite scary. More than once, while stretching for that last orange on that top branch, the ladder's flipped over, flicking me off, falling through the tree, landing on my back underneath of my bag of oranges. And then you get up, and then you start all over again because you know you got to feel that bag to get paid at the end of the day. So just that alone, you know, I'm looking at this orange with different eyes. And then they've been trying to invent a machine that would pick oranges so that people don't have to do this, so that they can get more money, right? A machine picking doesn't wear out, doesn't complain, doesn't get hurt, doesn't call in sick. But since the 1950s, interestingly enough, no one's come up with a solution to replace a human picker. Because then the next thing I learned in the video is that you have to be so careful about handling the fruit when you pick it so it can't be bruised, you can't squeeze it on the ladder, it can't be dropped, because the minute it gets dropped, then it gets bruised. And then, you know, it doesn't make it through the whole rest of the process of going to the processing plant, then the things have to get washed. There's an interesting thing I didn't know about this. This is very interesting. So in California, it isn't always toasty and warm. So this one place has these huge propellers throughout the orchard. And it's like these, well, there are propellers. They're up about 30 feet. And so what these propellers do is they bring down the warm air to warm up the fruit so that the fruit will ripen. And then they've got to have people service those propellers that stop working. So they get them off the tree. They're put into these large bins. They're transported by someone to the processing plant. So you've got drivers involved. You've got people taking a look at how the people are working. You've got supervisors in the field to make sure no one's sleeping underneath the orange tree. Of course, who would do that if you're trying to make money, right, to feed your family? So oftentimes the oranges, well, you can't pick the oranges until they're ripe, but sometimes they're picked and they're a little bit green. So then the next step is when they get to the factory, then they take them and put them in these bins, and they actually treat them with this kind of gas called ethylene gas. It's odorless, colorless, and it exists in nature. It's natural. And this helps ripen the fruit. So that's one thing they do. And then they get stored in a warehouse until it's time to wash them. So they get put through these conveyor belts. This is all machine stuff now. And they sort the oranges, big, medium, small, that's machines. And then, of course, they get them so that they're sorted into big, medium, and small. And then they have to run them through again so that people can pick out the damaged spots. Now, even humans can't see all the damages that happen. So then they get taken into this room that's lit up with black lights. So it's a dark room. People are working hours a day in a room that's just lit by black lights. And then underneath a black light, the bruises show up as bright yellow. So those oranges are nabbed and they're sent off to another place to be made into orange juice. And the ones that are really bad, they get turned into cattle feed. And then the really good ones are headed towards you and me. Again, that's people doing that for hours a day. Can you imagine that situation of being in a dark room where it's just black light? Probably you're doing that 8 hours a day. And then once they have the really good oranges and the medium, big and small sizes, then again, people are involved. And the video I saw was basically all women wearing down coats. And these conveyor belts are moving the oranges really fast. And so they're using all of their energy to try and pluck out the oranges that look damaged. And they're going full tilt. Can you imagine doing that job for 8 hours a day of just watching for the damaged fruit? And then the oranges that have made it, they're top grade oranges, and they get boxed, they get shipped all around the world. And then you and I show up at Safeway or wherever, and we pick out the oranges that we like the best. In the meantime, there's all the people who drove the trucks, the people that load those oranges onto ships, people unload the fruit, the people in that stock the shelves in the stores, the teller at the store. It's amazing how many people have come into contact with that one piece of fruit. So I challenge you to do this over the holidays. Pick your favorite food type, or maybe even pick water, and do some research. What's the source of the water that you're drinking? How many people are involved in making sure that water's clean? You know, we just go to the tap in this country, and we have the good fortune of just turning a tap. Many people in the world don't have that privilege. So it's really compelling and very good to do research on this. I had no idea about the orange. So Venerable Children goes on and she says, I'll just back up a bit. Without the efforts of all these people doing all these jobs, you wouldn't even have a mouthful of food to eat. And then you might say, and this is the self-centered thought talking, oh, come on. You know, I bought the food with my own money. That's true. But where did the money come from? Well, someone gave it to you. And then you'll say, well, I worked for that money. Yes, you did. We did. And even if you worked a job to get it, you still depend on the person who hired you. You depend on the customers, if that's in your line of business. You depend on the clients. And you depend on the company that you work for, the people in the accounts department who issue the check or put it into your bank account, the people at the bank, and it goes on and on and on. So it's really normal for the self-centered thought to say, those people aren't doing that to be kind to me. They're doing it just because they've got a job. Yes, that's true. But what happens when these people don't show up and do the job? So the self-centered thought keeps protesting and says, but they don't do this especially for me. And Venerable Children comes back with, so their motivation actually is not important. What is important is if they didn't do what they're doing, we would go hungry. And we eat due to their hard work and efforts. Surely that makes them kind. So in thinking about this, I think it was, yeah. So this isn't involving something with food, but this involves something else that's really important. And some of you weren't born in 1968, but I'll tell you what happened in 1968 in New York City. I think it's happened since then a few times. The workers collecting garbage went on strike in New York City. Does anyone remember that? Okay. So at that time, I took a look. The city population in New York was about 7.7 million people, and the workers went on strike. So people got a little bit agitated as the mounds of garbage started to grow and grow and grow. And then you can imagine the health hazards with garbage just sitting on the streets. And apparently the city looked like a vast slum as mounds of refuse grew higher and higher. And then strong winds would grab the bags that got ripped open because there'd be dogs running around, right? And swirling that garbage around New York City. Can you imagine the smell? By that point, there was about 30,000 tons of trash on the streets of New York City. That number would grow to 100,000 tons of garbage. So people wrote about this fact of seeing that garbage was piled chest high. I guess it depends on how tall you are. In my case, it would be... There were eggshells everywhere. There were coffee grounds. There were milk cartons. There were orange rinds. You name it. The streets of New York City were absolutely piled high with garbage. So, you know, if you've got the job right now of collecting garbage, that's a really important job. And I think, you know, if you ever have the chance of encountering the people who stop by and pick up your blue bin, do you have blue bins here? Whatever it is you put out in the street, you know, the compost, the recycling bin, the garbage. You know, this time of year especially, it'd be a really good time to maybe run out with a treat and thank them. Because I think a lot of people don't really have a lot of self-confidence maybe about being a garbage collector. But I think we can communicate our gratitude to them for that. So Venerable Children, being the teacher that she is, then goes on and says, she gives us more homework. So she says, look around. Pick an item. A chair, a book, a spoon, whatever. Then think about all the people involved in you having it. This includes not only the people directly involved in producing it, but also the people who designed and made the machinery used to produce it. Then consider the miners who got the raw materials and the people in the factories who processed it so it could be made into machinery that then produced the item in the room. And when we consider all the things we use each day that make our lives possible, the number of people and animals involved in our having them becomes uncountable. So this kind of topic is also really good medicine for when we're having a day and our mind is in a very low state. Maybe our mind is dipping towards deep sadness, maybe even depression. Maybe we're feeling totally discouraged because we looked at the headlines again and saw what was going on in this country. And this topic, just reflecting about the kindness of others, is really effective medicine. Of course, you won't know until you try it. But, you know, I'm encouraging you to try it. When you're having a low day or a low moment, pause, you know, go to the bathroom. For sure you can be alone there. And just reflect on the kindness of others that you've experienced, maybe that day, maybe that week. And that little time out will be a refresher. It will really help uplift your mind. From time to time, one of my teachers, this is one of Venerable Children's teachers, this is one of her first teachers, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, returns to his native area in the Himalayan mountains in Nepal. This is a region, as is the custom there, the villagers come to visit him and often bring him, as an offering, a bag of potatoes. And this is the staple food of the area to offer. Rinpoche once said that when he contemplated that all that the villagers had done so that he could even have one potato, he was overwhelmed by their kindness. The only way he could eat it, he told us, was if he generated compassion and vowed to use his life to benefit all beings. Now, this area of Nepal is extremely poor. It is so poor. It's quite high up. There's not a lot that grows there, and so potatoes are like gold. And the fact that people would bring him a bag of potatoes was a tremendously generous offering on their part, and he knew that. And so for him to even eat one potato, he's constantly generating this mind of wanting to benefit others. So she goes on. How many of us stop to thank the people installing the fiber optic lines to our home? How often do we thank those fixing the electric or telephone lines? How often do we thank those taking away the garbage or those who work on the roads? Sometimes we can even be irritated by these very people that we should be thankful for. And we may think, why are you fixing the road now when I need to get somewhere? You should be fixing this at 2 a.m. when no one else is driving on it. But as you've seen over and over again, these very people working on the roads, they work in all weather conditions. They work hard in the sun, they work in the rain, they work in the dark. And we benefit so much from their efforts. I think it was 2 years ago in 2017, we were on one of our drives into UU on a Monday night. It must have been fall, late fall. And they were resurfacing Highway 2. So when we were coming home in the dark, these road workers were out, it was pitch dark, resurfacing the road. And you know, in pitch dark, yeah, they're wearing reflective clothing, they've got those pylons that have reflectors, but it's so dangerous, you know? And can you imagine? Many of them are raising families, I'm sure, and they're out at night, they're missing part of their kids' childhood, they're missing connecting with their partner, and they're out there doing a very dangerous job. The fumes that they're breathing in, you know, I don't see a lot of people still wearing masks, doing that job. I guess it's not groovy to wear a mask. But, you know, they're breathing in this stuff that looks and smells to me like it's toxic. So I'm sure it's having, you know, the long-term effect on their health is great. I suppose some of the people driving the heavy equipment make a pretty good wage. But just consider what these people do so that we can drive to the Abbey, right? Or so that you can go on holidays, or that you can get to your workplace, get your kids to school. So this chapter really, really gets us to slow down and reflect on actually the endless numbers of kindnesses that we're recipients of every single day. The Venerable Trojan goes on, she says, especially with the global economy, we are indebted to numberless people in other countries, some working in dangerous or dreadful conditions to produce the goods we use. Do we think about them when we put on our shoes or when we use our computer? We can, and doing so, if we think about all the people involved in the things we use, will transform our minds. We should try to use the things in our environment with more care and awareness of what others have gone through to make them. To repay their kindness, we must practice compassion towards as many people and animals as we can. So at this point, I thought I'd share another little bit of information that I found quite amazing. It may seem contradictory to what this chapter is talking about, but initially, the whole idea of the plastic bag was meant to make life better for us, right? That it would be a convenience, it would help people. So I'm going to read you something fascinating from the United Nations Environment website that is a brief tracking of the plastic bag that we had this romance with, and now we're divorcing. So it started off in in 1933 with this chemical called polyethylene. And it was created by accident at a chemical plant in England, by accident. So they were creating this, whatever it was, and they got these small batches of polyethylene, and somebody probably looked at this and thought, that looks pretty useful. Well, guess what? It was useful. They started using it during World War II. Then we'll fast forward to 1965. The one-piece polyethylene shopping bag is patented by a Swedish company, designed by an engineer by the name of Stefan Tulin, and it quickly began to replace the cloth bag used in Europe. So, you know, we're on the right track, and then, boom, the romance starts. Plastic. In 1979, already controlling 80% of the bag market in Europe, plastic bags go abroad. I thought it was sooner than that, but according to the UN website, it was 1979 that we were inundated with this. And it was widely introduced to the United States. Plastic companies began to aggressively market their product as superior to paper and reusable bags. Right? Latest and greatest. Then 1982, Safeway and Kroger, two of the biggest supermarket chains in the United States, all switched to plastic bags. More stores follow suit, and by the end of the decade, plastic bags will have replaced paper around the world. That's 1982. 1997, a sailor and researcher discovers the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It was the largest of several gyres in the world's oceans, where immense amounts of plastic waste have accumulated, threatening marine life. Plastic bags are notorious for killing sea turtles, which mistakenly think they're jellyfish and they eat them. So that's 1997. 2002. Which country in the world do you think put a ban on plastic? Plastic bags, actually. 2002. Good guesses. You haven't hit it yet. I was astounded. You're getting close. Bangladesh. Bangladesh in 2002 was the first country in the world to ban plastic bags. Because they found that there, these plastic bags were clogging drainage systems and causing disastrous flooding. And so then finally, in 2002, at their lead, other countries started to follow suit. Isn't that amazing? 2018, Beat Plastic Pollution becomes the theme of the World Environment Day, hosted in 2018 by India. Companies and governments around the world continue to announce new pledges to tackle toxic waste and plastic waste. So I'm bringing this to our attention today because, you know what, it started off with a good intention. It was like it was convenient, it would be good for us. And it took off in such a wrong direction. And now we're reeling ourselves back in. And so we can think of Bangladeshis as we say no thank you to the plastic bags that they still want to hand out to us. And we use the recyclable bags to preserve the planet and prevent the ongoing pollution. So Venerable Children goes on and she says, not only do all the objects we use and enjoy come from others, but also everything we know and all the skills we have are due to others. So then the self-centered thought raises its head again and says, wait a minute. I'm an intelligent person. Nobody gave me my brains. We may have the potential to learn a lot and develop many skills, but that potential is useless without people who encourage us, who have taught us. Without all the people who taught us how to talk, we wouldn't even have the basic elementary skill upon which all our other abilities are founded. Without people who made the musical instrument and taught us how to play it, we wouldn't be able to play music. The same goes for computer whizzes, builders, athletes, secretaries, artists, engineers, and everybody else. We only have the skills we have because others developed the knowledge and then cared enough to teach us. So this is another bit of homework that we should do over the holiday season, is to think about all the skills we currently have. And for sure the self-centered thought will say, no, I had this gift. I was talented from the age of 3. I had a little bit of help here and there, but you know what? I'm gifted. There's no one to thank. And then just check it out. Is that really true? How many people here were parents, are parents? Okay, did your child come out of the womb talking? When I'm around my nieces, I get to see babies these days. And so it's a tremendous reminder. If you're not around babies right now, go and find some over the holiday season. And watch their caregivers. Watch the parents, watch the aunts, watch the grandmas. Look at how every moment that little being is being taught something. And then just think, that was true for me. Look at all the help we had. You know, just tying our shoe. And then again, you'll say, no, I taught myself how to tie my shoes. Well, maybe. But, you know, there's a whole lot of other things that we know now how to do, and someone took the time to show us. How many people here are really good at sewing? How many people here enjoy cooking? How many people ski? How many people here think they're an expert at something? So just, you know, it would be so interesting. You know, eventually when we're Buddhas, I would like to take a picture of this, where we line up everybody behind us, you know, even in just one life, who taught us something. And you may say, but I didn't like my grade 3 teacher. She was mean to us. Well, you know what? She wasn't mean every moment of the day, or he. And I think if we could line up all these people and then take a photograph. That would probably stretch for miles. And then if you're up for thinking about endless rebirths and all the help we've had over previous lifetimes, we'd need a very wide-angle lens. It just would go beyond what we can even appreciate as an ordinary person. So it's very heartwarming, actually. Again, something to do when your mind starts to dip. Bring to mind someone who taught you something that you still know how to do. Or maybe you don't know how to do it anymore. Maybe you had a favorite teacher that taught you how to play the clarinet in band and you don't play it anymore. And just think about what was involved in them having the skills to teach you and who their teachers were. And that they took the time to show us how to do these things. And it's a fantastic antidote also for the mind of pride that thinks, well, I was gifted. I was in the gifted class. I was the smartest one. Those teachers were all dumber than me. You know, I don't think all the teachers were dumber than us. I really don't. And then as Venerable Children likes to point out, when she was a teenager, she thought her parents were just so not smart. Not smart at all. And then as she, you know, aged, she began to see the great wisdom in the kind of guidance that she got from her mom and her dad. And I think that can be true for all of us. And if it wasn't a parent, it was a caregiver, maybe it was a relative, maybe it was a teacher at school. And that we are not where we're at without the help of others. Not at all. When we think about it, the web of interdependent relationships connecting us to all living beings is huge. And we're able to live precisely because of their efforts and kindnesses. When we contemplate this deeply, we will never feel estranged from others. Contemplating this over time will lead us to recognize that we have been the recipient of tremendous kindness from the day we were born until now. I want to go back and read that sentence. When we contemplate this deeply, how connected we are to others, we will never feel estranged from others. Now, maybe right now never's a little bit strong, but again, this is a really big antidote to feeling, you know, if there's pangs of loneliness or we feel like we don't fit in, we're just not connecting with people at work these days, you know, the family's kind of on shaky ground right now. When we think about the help we receive from others, that really takes care of that kind of mind and gets us going in the right direction. Opening ourselves to this fact, our gratitude and feeling of closeness with others will increase and remain constant instead of jumping from love to hatred whenever we think that they are doing something wrong. This establishes a firm foundation for generating love and compassion. So there's a lot in this very short chapter to think about. And it's a very beautiful topic to bring to mind again and again. And so right now I'd like to lead us in a short meditation. This is right out of the book. So if you have this book, you can do this again. I don't know, do it for the month of December. You'll be different January 1st. And let's do some reflection on this topic. Choose an aspect of your life, perhaps something you use regularly, or an activity you frequently engage in, or a skill that you have. Consider the many beings whose efforts made this aspect of your life possible. Allow yourself to receive their efforts as kindness and to experience a strong sense of gratitude towards them. Continue by considering the ways in which so many others have contributed to our well-being. Conclude by feeling that you have been the recipient of tremendous kindness in your life. And when we do this kind of reflection, the wish to repay the kindness that others have given us may arise. I'm wondering if anyone would like to share from your experience someone that comes to mind who taught you something or showed a kindness to you that kind of stays forever in your mind and heart. Okay, I'll start. Okay. When I was a teenager, I wanted to ski so badly. And I was living in a town. My parents didn't have much money, and this is downhill skiing, and even then it was expensive. So my dad gave me a job, and he was an electrical contractor and had a store as well that sold electrical appliances. I was his worst employee. Nothing had prices on it. He didn't tell me what the things cost, so when the customers come in, I would hide. So, but he paid me, and I managed to save up money for ski lessons and ski equipment. But the person who, and then, so my dad was very kind in doing that. And then our family dentist would drive us 60 miles to the nearest ski hill on a school night so we could get ski lessons. So he'd work the whole day as a dentist, and he'd get about 6 or 8 of us in his car. He had a station wagon, probably not very fossil fuel efficient, but he got a lot of kids in that car, and we would ride in, and we'd go to the ski hill for ski lessons. He did that for years for kids. You know, that really stands out in my mind. Okay, who else?
Comes to mind is when I was in 8th grade, and I always took art classes, and I had a really nice art teacher, and I didn't realize how spoiled I had been. My dad was very poor, but he became a physician. We always had everything we needed, and so I can remember I was in this art class, and I was just having fun, and I was lining up all these sheets of paper and just smashing staplers just for fun to staple them, and the teacher got so upset with me. But it really taught me a lesson of something that I was completely blind to, was just wasting things and not being aware of resources, you know, in that way, just because I hadn't ever had to go without, you know. And even though my dad really kind of enforced this in me, something had been missing, you know, just kind of oblivious. And I really always have remembered that and thanked her for that, even though at the moment it was like, well, I didn't really get upset. I was just kind of clueless, like, what's the problem here, you know? But I thought about it, you know, it didn't take long. So I always appreciated that. She was very supportive.
So when I was in my early 30s, I was diagnosed with major depression, like really, really bad. Like, so bad that, like, I couldn't even go to the grocery store and choose the cereal, what cereal to choose, because that just took too much thought. And that depression was all related to a pretty traumatic childhood. So the person that came to my mind was a man who's still alive, and he's in his 90s. And his name is Dr. Edward Green. He's a psychiatrist. He had an office on Park Avenue in New York that I went to once, and then he lived in White Plains, and he had a spiral staircase that you had to go up to get to the second story of his house where he had built an office. And I would drive myself across the Tappan Zee Bridge at least 2 times a week to see him. And there were so many bad things that I had to deal with that you could call him at 4 o'clock in the morning and you'd get an answering service at 4 o'clock, and I'd tell them my name, and they would say, you know, he'll call you back. And within like 10 or 15 minutes, he would call me back. And he was that healthy parent that I had not had as a child. And he actually also worked with a lot of little children, but he's who came to my mind, and the fact that I now can tell that story and not have any shame, but instead have enormous gratitude.
So I had the privilege of playing volleyball, which is a skill, as you mentioned, for more than 15 years as a professional even. But that all began with the kindness of my parents being willing to drive me 45 minutes to and from practice every day as a teenager. And many, many coaches, obviously. But there was one specifically the first year I played organized club volleyball, who offered to do private lessons with me once a week for months and months and months at no extra pay. It was just one-on-one, us in a gym, and him providing me this foundation and the skills by sharing his knowledge, without which I could never have done what I went on to do. So very grateful for all the coaches, but especially Mike. So,
yes, thank you.
I have been a voracious reader ever since I was a child, and it must have been when I was in my 20s, I got the idea that the authors of the books that I read were my friends, because they were telling me a story, and they were teaching me something. So I always thought that they were so kind to me to write all these marvelous books that expanded my mind and taught me the world.
Oh, I was thinking about my father. I was in Boy Scouts, and so we were in summer camp, and my father showed up later in the week and came, and you know, he kind of grew up in the mountains in Europe, and he had a lot of outdoor skills. But anyway, in any case, he was teaching us to catch. Like, we did all kinds of different things that he was teaching us. But I mean, we were making these little live traps that you see on the cartoons where you pull the thing, you know, so we're catching raccoons, and we even caught a skunk, and that wasn't very cool. And then, but there was this pit, and my dad was putting a noose on this pole, and we were catching snakes, pulling them out and stuff. I mean, as a kid, that's cool, you know, and it was cool actually. So what also my dad imparted to us was okay, we caught them, now we need to let them go. But the reason I say this is because, I learned from my father how to be kind to animals, you know, they have a purpose, they have a reason, and, I mean, the reason for, an importance, I should say, and that, I don't know, I just thought it was so, so cool to get that from him, and, it didn't stop me from wanting to hunt later when I was, thankfully I never actually killed anything, but still, I can appreciate his kindness for teaching us that.